Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Right Now Weekly Radio Show, hosted by Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Publishing, home of best-selling books, award-winning magazines, global broadcasts and communities. Right Now is a highly educational, inspiring, and empowering show focused on writing, publishing, and marketing your books, featuring outstanding guests from across the globe, including best-selling authors, world stage speakers, thought leaders, and visionaries with proven strategies, secret formulas, and treasured resources to help you succeed and make an impact. Welcome, sit back, and enjoy the show. And now your host, Vicki Winterton.
Hi, this is Vicki Winterton, and it's such a great honor today because with us we have Senator Omar Raines. Senator Omar Raines is an unbelievable figure in politics. He's also an attorney. He's an activist for all sorts of amazing things going on all over the world, and he is also a survivor of an aneurysm and stroke, which to his knees. So he's going to be talking with us about all of these things, including his wonderful international bestseller, Back to the Summit. Omar, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome. I'm delighted.
So, Omar, I'd love to start out by you sharing with us a little bit about your book, Back to the Summit, because it is so inspirational. What inspired you to actually write this wonderful work?
Well, I did have a ruptured brain aneurysm and associated hemorrhagic stroke in 2002. I'd led a very adventurous and difficult life with rather high peaks and rather deep valleys, but that ought to have killed me. And when I did manage, however, to make a recovery, it was one that I was told should and could serve as an inspiration to many people around the world who had suffered major maladies, challenges, strokes. And it was for that reason the book was written, hopefully to inspire others to never, never give up.
Oh, I love that. And you have led such a powerful life. When this aneurysm and stroke came on, that must have been quite shocking to you because you're in absolutely above average, to say the least, vibrant health. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was at the time in good shape. There's no doubt about it, good physical shape. But I, to be sure, did not recall what happened. I have an 8-day period of retrograde and antegrade amnesia. What I do know is that I ended up in a hospital in Sacramento, California. No idea how I got there. I underwent a 9-hour brain operation, a technique never before tried in the U.S. It was one that had been developed in London, and by one of multiple miracles, they had on staff an Indian that had been trained in this new technique. But in any event, there were multiple physicians involved. It was about a 9-hour operation. Thereafter, I was 8 days in a coma. I was in critical condition in ICU for over a month and ultimately carried home paralyzed, told I would never walk again. And, you know, I'm blessed. I don't know how and why, but my book is basically about the way in which the recovery was made.
Well, you obviously came to walk again and all the other amazing things you're doing, the charitable works that you do, in many cases, even more than you did before than when you were struck down. So tell us a little bit about what that recovery was like for you and what that looks like now.
Well, the recovery, to be sure, was very, very difficult. And how I managed to make it, I do write in the book. But why I'm alive, I cannot quite frankly explain. Some people say I'd overcome so many challenges in life, and I had, I know that I had tenacity, willpower, determination that perhaps exceeded that of most people. Others say, including a famous neurosurgeon, one of my treating neurosurgeons, that the Creator, if there is one, simply isn't finished with you yet. I don't know. I will never know. I do know that I'm blessed. Life is good. and I did make a recovery. The book is about the steps I made toward recovery. It's accompanied by flashbacks and flash forwards chronicling one challenge after another I had overcome during my life and how those life experiences might have enabled me to overcome what the doctors said would not be possible, that is, to walk and to again lead an active and meaningful life. Even by the time I came home, carried home in a paralytic state on a gurney, I had already overcome aphasia and amnesia. The doctors were already amazed. How are you able to recollect? How are you able to communicate? Because I was doing those things earlier than they thought would be possible. But they were sure that I'd be paralyzed the rest of my life. I would never walk again. I would never lead an active and meaningful life of any kind. And in a way, that inspired me to try that much harder. Because even though I wouldn't say it aloud, every time I heard that, and I heard it repeatedly, I would say to myself, forgive the expression, bullshit. I'm going to walk within 30 days. Within 60 days, I'm going to shoot some hoops. Within 90 days, I'm going to do some spring skiing. Within 120 days, I'm going to play some softball. I mean, it was in my 60s by the time. And thereafter, everything. And I was determined to meet those goals. And I did. Not to the extent I did before. I mean, don't get me wrong. There were still impediments to overcome. But I was out mountain biking and doing things that I had historically done. And because that's the life I lead. It's a life I had led, and I was determined to lead it again.
Now, you have not only done great things before, but certainly done great things since. You're meant for greatness, and you're meant to be with us to continue that greatness for many years to come. So, again, so thrilled to have you here, and so thrilled that you're making the kind of contribution that you've always made in even a greater way to the world. It's so interesting to me because I learned from the book that you were born in a small town in the Ozarks without any electricity or running water. And after your family moved to California, you left home at age 15 and managed to put yourself through 7 years of undergraduate and graduate work at UC Berkeley. How did you do that with any parental help or governmental assistance?
You know, Vicki, thinking back on it, I guess it is a fairly amazing story. From age 11 on, there was never a time when I wasn't working, generally multiple jobs at a time. Don't get me wrong, I don't recommend that as a way to grow up. But at the end of the day, you surely come to value the importance of hard work and overcoming challenges. In my case, it probably also had a lot to do with me having the, again, tenacity, willpower, and determination to overcome whatever challenge I encountered along the way. And certainly those you mentioned were those I overcame. You're right, I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks, born on a farm, no running water, no electricity, obviously no telephone, no TV, no radio, things that others take for granted. But it wasn't that unusual in the era in which I was born. I mean, FDR was still president. It was 1941, so before we entered World War II. Anyway, that is the case. And yes, from age 15 on, I was living on my own. I was working multiple jobs, field labor, rock mason, you name it, anything that provided an opportunity to make some money, I did. And when I went to the University of California, Berkeley, I realized that because of my high school years, and of those I'm not real proud because I did some pretty crazy things, but I got it out of my system. I have a saying I often use, and I believe it, that sooner or later everyone has to sow wild oats. And thank goodness I got it out of my system early, because most people, I think, do not, and it harms them to a greater degree when they're adults than when they're young. And so when I went to Berkeley, realizing that I would have to overcome yet more challenges, especially financial in nature, I put my heart and soul into that, working multiple jobs again as I took courses. And I finished my undergraduate work in 4 years, went on to law school for 3 years, and I did it all on my own. No government help, no parental help. And was it difficult? My God, yes. But you do in life what you have to do. And that's the way in which I had grown up, and that's the way I continue to lead my life. I guess I do things I don't have to do right now, but they're very enriching to me. Because after my recovery, to the extent I made a recovery, and it was 99% full, I dedicated my life to helping others. And that's what my life is all about today, and has been since 2002.
It's such an amazing story, and it doesn't end there. I mean, when you got out of college, it seems you kept that same amazing pace, and especially with your in all sorts of public service, so much so that my understanding from reading the book is that at age 29, you were recognized as outstanding citizen of Ventura, California, and then at 32, you were elected to the California Senate representing over 1 million people, and then only 2 years afterwards, you were one of the key people in a presidential campaign. That is an incredible rise. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is true. I was, by this time, a confirmed alcoholic. I had been, but be that as it may, I was involved during the 20s. After I got out of law school, I eventually became involved in, and this is crazy, I don't recommend this, but I was involved in 15 different organizations or agencies or commissions, some state, some local, one or two national, and I was chairing 12 of the 15 and continuing to make a living for my family, because by this time I not only was married but had 2 young children. And you're right, I was recognized by age 29 as the outstanding citizen of Ventura, and I guess that gave a lot of recognition to me. I, for a lot of reasons, by age 32, because of deaths of others in office, ended up seeking the California Senate seat. Most of the coastal area between San Francisco and Los Angeles, well over 1 million people. It was the largest seat of its kind in the nation, because our Senate seats in California are so much larger than anywhere else. And they were indeed far larger than a congressional seat. And in running in a district in which no one thought I would win, myself included, I suppose, to some degree, because one of my party had never carried that area, I ended up being, by about 25 years, the youngest in the Senate at that time. And, yeah, I gained the attention of a number of people, and you're right, I guess by 34, I was deeply involved in a presidential campaign at quite a high level.
Wow, that's quite incredible. And being a California girl, I believe that Ronald Reagan was governor of California when you were first elected. What was your impression of him?
You know, Ronald Reagan and I became the closest of friends. I happened to run as a Democrat, although I'm a fiscal conservative, and I disagreed with many of his programs and policies. But as a person, I liked him a lot. And we remained close friends for over 30 years. And I got to tell you, unlike what most Republican candidates today suggest, because they obviously never worked with a man or never knew him, not only was Reagan a person you liked to be around, he was very easy to work with, always willing to compromise when necessary. In fact, he often quoted the famous political scientist Walt Lippmann, "Politics, the art of compromise." And too many politicians today have lost sight of that. And when he went on and became president, who was his best friend in Congress? Far and away, the liberal Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill, probably the most liberal member of the House. Because I was often a guest of Reagan's at the White House. You know, flew on Air Force One, Marine One, blah, blah. And he told me more than once, "I don't know what I would do without Tips. He's the one person I can trust." He and I had a standing joke, because not only was his Western White House in my district in the San Ynez Mountains, because I represented Bend County, Ventura County, Northern LA County, you know, Santa Barbara County, up into San Luis Obispo County, and on up the coast. And, you know, the Simi Valley Reagan Library is actually in that district as well. But he would often refer to me, and this was just a standing joke, "He's president, I'm a state senator," and he would always call me my senator. You couldn't help but like him. He did Whatever you thought of his policies, he just exuded the shiny city on the mountaintop personality. He did. And it was at a time when our nation really did need that. He would never have been a member of a party of no. He simply would not have. I remember him with great fondness.
He's one of my favorites, too. So tell me a little bit about Jimmy Carter. I know you were his California state chair and Western states co-chair as early as 1974 when he defeated Gerald Ford. And you were a frequent visitor to the White House and flew with the president and Air Force One and were present for the signing of Camp David records. It just goes on and on. You must have known him pretty well.
I did, and I do. Carter was probably the most intelligent and best-read president in modern U.S. history. I know that goes against what most people believe, not internationally where he's revered, but here at home. But Carter, unlike some presidents, kind of like Obama today, inherited a mess. What with the country still traumatized by both Vietnam and Watergate, with an inflationary spiral resulting in large measure by the OPEC oil embargo, with the taking of American hostages in Tehran, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, there were some remarkable achievements during his presidency for which he hasn't been given sufficient credit by the U.S. public. He brokered the peace between Egypt and Israel, and I was at Camp David, and I could talk about that at great length, but he also entered into the SALT II arms control treaty with the Soviet Union, which was critical to the eventual normalization with the Soviet Union. And also, he was the person who normalized relations with China. Nixon first had gone to China and had opened the door, but it was Carter that normalized those relationships. He had an ongoing commitment to an emphasis on human rights throughout the world, which he has continued after his presidency. He gave us repeated warnings, largely ignored, of the danger of our unrelenting and ever-expanding dependence on foreign oil and the need to harness alternative and renewable sources of energy such as wind, solar, geothermal, developing ocean technologies, etc. And that was tragic, as we all too well know today, because people made fun of him when he put solar panels on the White House, when he gave his fireside address with a sweater on. You know, he was speaking the truth. And I do believe that Carter, and this may have been a weakness, Carter said, "I will never lie to the American public." And insofar as I know, he never did. Maybe sometimes as president you have to fudge a bit. He wouldn't. He didn't. And he didn't respond when people criticized him. And it was mainly special interest. I mean, when he said we cannot have this unrelenting commitment to oil and fossil fuels, it's causing us to have economic turmoil and problems, it's causing emissions, it's going to cause climate change. I mean, the things he was predicting happened, and yet people made fun of him. What people? Mainly those that were economically affected, those who had a pecuniary interest, the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, coal. And they bombarded the airways with their commercials and what have you. And it worked. Again, people start poo-pooing what he was saying. He was saying the truth as we know today. He was saying absolutely the truth. And any thoughtful person should have known that. But it took us decades thereafter before the majority of people realized, oh my God, he was right. Although most people don't think back that far and realize we were being warned clear back in the 70s.
You know, he has the presence of someone who is tremendously courageous and yet gracious. There's a softness about him with some of the challenges that he's facing now.
It's inspirational. Whatever one thinks of Jimmy Carter, whatever one thinks of his administration, he certainly, perhaps more than any president or former president in U.S. history, has demonstrated or taught us how a former president ought to conduct himself. I mean, my Lord, the good work he does throughout the world, especially the lesser developed world, whether it's health problems, education problems, whether it's just humanitarian civil rights, whether it's monitoring elections and being an international observer in turmoil and turbulent parts of the world. It's just extraordinary. His books that have been written, I think, what, 29 now, are wonderful. And he writes them. They aren't ghostwritten. These books that you're seeing on the shelves right now by almost every politician, especially those running for public office, they aren't writing them themselves. My God, they're coming out in the midst of a campaign where they're all over the country rather than dealing with their own responsibilities as elected officials. They're all being ghostwritten. He wrote his books, each and every one, every word. He's a brilliant man. Let's face it, he was a nuclear physicist. He was Hyman Rickover's right hand. He's brilliant. He's a brilliant man. And that southern accent is very beguiling, very beguiling. Too many people think he may not be as sharp as would otherwise be the case because of that accent, but that's very, very wrong. One of the most memorable experiences, and I won't go into the whole thing, but we were on a campaign plane, the election with Gerald Ford, and we had been in about six cities in one day all over the western U.S., and we ended up in San Francisco, and it was quite late at night. We'd had a lot of problems, including the breakdown of a bus that had picked us up at the airport, blah, 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 blah. And he had gone to bed. He had retired very late. And there were some self-anointed Latino leaders that demanded to meet with him and said that if they didn't, they would switch their endorsement to Gerald Ford and remove it from Carter. So Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell and myself, we went back and forth, and should we awaken the candidate, because he was not yet president. And eventually the decision was made to do so. So I'm the one that knocks on the door of his hotel room. He comes, he's groggy, he's in his pajamas, and he agrees to come down and meet with him. He says, give me a little time to throw some clothes on. Come on in. I went into the room. As he's getting ready, I look down at the end table next to his bed, and I see the Bible. Well, I knew he was a religious man, very religious, very committed. But what struck me is that the Bible was written in Spanish. And I inquired of him later. I said, Governor, because he was not yet president, the Bible you were reading when you went to sleep is in Spanish. And he said, yes, yes. Well, you know, I'm a peanut farmer from Georgia. I didn't speak other languages. And in the Navy, I thought I ought to acquire the ability to confer or speak in another language, especially one where there are a lot of people in our country who speak Spanish. And I began to study it, and I gained a facility, and he did. He was very fluent in Spanish. And he said, in order to keep up my facility, I read often in Spanish. I read the Bible in Spanish, and it allows me to continue with the facility I do have, the fluency I do have in Spanish. Otherwise, it would be impossible. And that just shows the, number one, intelligence of the man, number two, the dedication of the man, number three, the ability to stay with something that he thought to be important. You know, I think highly of Carter. I really do. Whatever others think is irrelevant to me. I think highly of the man. Did he make mistakes? Yes, he made some major mistakes. Major one, in my opinion. You know, and this is a good contrast with Reagan, both of whom I admire greatly. But Reagan delegated almost everything. He delegated to an extraordinary degree, and sometimes it got him in trouble. The Iran-Contra affair is a classic example. Carter, on the other hand, wanted to get involved in all of the minutiae. He wanted to know everything about everything, and I don't think that can be done if you're president of the United States. And I think that was one of the downfalls, that he just was too committed to knowing everything that was happening in his administration, all of the policies, and, you know, down to things that were pretty ridiculous. So they were kind of extremes, and they were diametrically opposed from that standpoint. Both great men, but quite different from that standpoint.
So fascinating. Well, you have had so many people that are really great and powerful touch your life, and you have touched so many others. How many presidents have you known?
To the best of my recollection, seven. I think all of them from JFK forward, with the exception of George W. Bush. And although I've spoken to him, I have not met Barack Obama, but and a lot of foreign leaders as well, you know, including Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, François Mitterrand of France, Gerhard Schroeder of Germany, Menachem Begin, of Israel, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan, Nelson Mandela, and many others. I realized, and I was with him several times, that I was in presence of true greatness. 200 years from now, you can say Mandela, and people will know what you're saying, who you're talking about. And there aren't many people on this earth today about which that can be said. But I did serve as a consultant at Mandela's request for the Constitutional Revision Commission when the apartheid system was dissolved, was crushed in South Africa.
That is just amazing. Well, while we're talking about leaders of other nations, in addition to Mandela, is there anyone else who really struck you as particularly great or impressive?
Yes, Anwar Sadat especially. I was at the Camp David Accords. I got to know Menachem Begin well and Anwar Sadat well and their respective wives and a lot of others. But one thing that was very moving, we had out on the White House lawn the day the Camp David Accord was signed, we had a huge state dinner, and there were equal numbers of Americans, Egyptians, and Israelis. And we were seated at various tables. And seated right across from me was the equivalent of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff for the country of Egypt. And there came a point in the dinner when, during the conversation, there were a lot of people at the table, but he said, and he had a chilling look in his eye, and he loved his president, Anwar Sadat. And he said, "Tonight, my president has signed his death warrant, and he knows it." And that just sent chills down my back. Sure enough, not long thereafter, as history reflects, Sadat was assassinated because of that. He was assassinated, actually, by the Egyptian military on the tarmac in Cairo. I've always admired Sadat. He was really intelligent. He was so impressive in person. He was so articulate, so thoughtful. So even before what happened thereafter, I was impressed with the man, especially impressed with him, and with others as well. But Sadat really stood out. And then after I heard that remark, and after he was, in fact, assassinated, I gained even greater admiration. I do think that he realized when he signed that accord, which has now stood for over 35 years, he realized that he probably was signing his death warrant, but he felt it so important to try to secure peace in the Mideast, certainly between Egypt and Israel, and Egypt was the biggest enemy of Israel at the time, that it would have a lasting effect that was more important to him than his own life. Yes, that resonated with me. That moved me greatly. And to this day, it does. I have tremendous respect and admiration for Anwar Sadat.
So interesting. Your own legislative accomplishments are staggering, to put it mildly. We're just covering the tip of the iceberg here today, but they clearly had a lasting influence on my home state of California. And not only that, but the entire nation. All of these accomplishments, are there any that really stand out for you?
Well, quite a few. I mean, let's face it, I know a lot of people may not want to hear this, but California in many ways is the engine that runs America. At the time, it was the fifth largest economy in the entire world. We're an independent nation state. And being but one of 40 members making decisions was far, far more important than serving as 143 members of Congress, no doubt about it. And as a result, I did work and help establish and expand Redwoods National Park, working mainly with Congressman Phil Burton, who was working at the federal level, and I was working at the state level. I helped establish the Channel Islands National Park. The work I did in the area of human and civil rights was of critical importance to me, taking the legislative leadership in connection with the promotion of women's rights, my work for the protection of innocent children and elderly, people without the special interest backing that most of the corporate and special interests have. However, I'm probably best remembered for a lifetime of work to preserve and protect all aspects of our environment, clean air and water, and specific and lasting actions to preserve and protect our beaches, our rivers, our mountains, our deserts, and our forests. And I could go on and on, but those were areas of special interest, along with that of political reform and promotion of alternative forms of energy. Those were sometimes successful, sometimes not. I will tell you, my most significant failures, and I did have failures, were actually in the area of political reform, especially those related to campaign financing and reapportionment. You know, most people don't realize the importance of reapportionment, but reapportionment, or gerrymandering of districts, drawing district lines, they reside in the hands of state legislatures. And gerrymandering, named after a former governor, Eldridge Gerry of Massachusetts, is where you draw these dragon-like districts. The fact is that today there are only a handful of congressional districts in the entire country that are marginal, that are up for grabs. Most of them are incredibly safe, where it would be almost impossible to displace either a Republican or a Democrat, depending upon the district and depending upon the way in which boundaries are drawn. Reagan, to his credit, and over the objection of his Republican colleagues in the California legislature and the Republicans in Congress, vetoed the 1970 Reapportionment Act, because what happened, Democrats were in the majority. They went to each Republican member and said, we're going to give you a safe district. We're going to give you a district that you can't possibly lose. You've got a 55% registration edge. We're going to give you an 80% registration. Now, why did they do that? They did that because with California's burgeoning population, they were going to get, in that case, five additional seats. And they wanted to carve out districts that Democrats would occupy. And what it meant was that it would be virtually impossible for a decade for the Republicans to again, if ever, gain control of either the lower house or the California Senate. You know, Reagan said, you know, this isn't right, and he vetoed the bill. The incumbents said, no, please don't do this, Governor, please don't. I mean, it's protecting us, making us really safe. And he said, yes, but it's not good government. What happened, it ended up in the courts. There was an independent commission established. And what they did, they conformed districts to communities of interest. To the extent possible, they recognized city boundaries, county boundaries, and you did not have these dragon-like things. It was far and away, and every political scientist realizes it, writes about it, speaks about it, but people don't understand it. But it was far and away the best reapportionment ever done, in, not only in California, but in the United States. I give Reagan credit for that. And I'm sad that the U.S. Supreme Court has saw fit to allow horrible, horrible reapportionment plans to stand. I mean, Tom DeLay, who's ethically challenged, managed to change seven congressional districts in one election in Texas by drawing the most bizarre lines, where even neighbors or people across the street from each other were in different parties and different districts. And I mean, it's just insane what goes on today. And that, unfortunately, is going to require a constitutional amendment to change, but it should happen. And by the way, it could happen without a constitutional amendment. It could happen state by state. California, and I introduced that bill every year. I introduced every year I was in the Senate a bill to take reapportionment out of the hands of the California legislators. And I gained a lot of flack. I mean, there is nothing more important to an elected official than the ability to draw his or her own lines. But it's bad government, very bad government. And, you know, I think the two-party system, Vicki, has really served this country relatively well historically. Because what happened is the following. Historically, that party that most effectively occupied the center won elections. So what does that mean? It meant the Democrats on the left, the Republicans on the right, if you want to be simplistic, were looking toward each other at all times. They were looking toward the center, drawing toward each other because they had to effectively get the center to win elections. And a lot of people said, well, our policies are twiddledy and twiddledum. There's not that much difference between the parties. And that was true. But that gave great stability to our government. What we have today, the Republicans in safe districts, all they have to do is look to the extreme of their party. They can only be challenged in the primary. Their party is going to win the election in these safe districts. And so they're always looking outward, not inward. Same thing with Democrats to the left. Got to make sure, get by the primary, look outward, not inward. So whereas historically we looked at each other and had compromise and congeniality and worked in a collaborative fashion across the aisles, Today, both parties are looking outward. They don't talk. They don't meet. They don't usually even know each other except across the aisle. And it's sad. And that's exactly the result of reapportionment of these safe districts. State by state, it can be done. California now, because of an initiative that got on the ballot, and you have to give Governor Schwarzenegger credit. He's the one that signed the bill. And the deciding vote was by a California Republican that put it on the ballot. And as a result, it was the first state to do that. Vermont has followed suit now, and I think two or three other states. But it's going to have to be done state by state unless you amend the Constitution, which is going to be almost impossible because it's so difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution and takes so long. That must be done, though, if we again are going to have a political system that's not dysfunctional, but that works again, and where people work together again, regardless of affiliation of party, regardless of philosophical differences. Philosophical differences are important, but things can be worked out, and that was the strength of Reagan. You know, Reagan did compromise repeatedly, one time after another, and people don't give him credit for that. He was not only the great communicator, he was the great compromiser. You know, whatever one's view, you know, and we all know that he raised taxes repeatedly when he felt it necessary, both as governor and as president. When I asked the question, guess who signed California's Therapeutic Abortion Act, they always looked dumbfounded. It was Ronald Reagan. And they always say, oh, that's impossible, you know, that couldn't be. Then they check the records, and they find out it not only could be, it was. But that's, for illustrative purposes, a classic example of the way Reagan was willing to compromise, to work back and forth. And whether you agreed or disagreed with that bill, that was what happened. And Reagan was supportive and did sign it into law. And again, I'm not speaking to the merits or demerits. I'm not sure I was that enthusiastic about it or at all enthusiastic. But that's just a typical example of Reagan's ability to compromise, to sit down and reason together and work out something that was therapeutic in nature, and there are all sorts of exceptions. But it happened, and it happened because of Ronald Reagan.
It's so interesting. Well, you and your political career painted with a pretty wide brush as well, because although it may seem like at times you had a pretty liberal agenda, you were known as a physical conservative, weren't you?
Well, I was. I hate the labels, you know, I really do. But if I have to label myself, you know, there's no doubt about it, and I have over 20,000 votes to evidence it, I was a fiscal conservative. I was a social progressive, and I was probably a libertarian at heart. But I wear proudly the badge of fiscal responsibility and conservative. I've always believed in and fought for fiscal responsibility at all levels of government. And that includes living within a balanced budget, includes line item veto power, sunset provision, zero-based budgeting, government reorganization for purposes of efficiency and cost-cutting, and sharp and complete restrictions, indeed elimination of all tax credits and loopholes. One thing that probably can't be changed, you know, in California, for example, if you amend a bill, it has to be germane to the bill being amended. In Congress, these 20,000-page bills, they can throw anything and everything, even if it's completely unrelated. If you have a bill on education reform, it can be amended to throw in transportation matters, military spending, my God, medical issues, you name it, anything, and it can be completely unrelated to the reason for which the bill was originally introduced. And it's all driven by special interests, mainly trying to get tax credits, exemptions, and fiscal advantages. And it is sad. People don't read 20,000-page bills, including those who are voting on them, I might add, but they're doing the bidding of special interest. We have to address that in one fashion or another, because it's a nightmare. You know, we're printing money like crazy right now. We're devaluing the dollar. You know, people think, oh, the U.S. dollar is really strong. It's doing better against the euro, against the Japanese yen, against other hard currencies of the world. Well, that's very misleading. The value of the dollar is being devalued on an ongoing basis, but all the others are even weaker. So the expression I sometimes use is, yeah, we're the tallest of the midgets, but we're all midgets right now. And there will come a time, who knows when, but time will show eventually that unless we change course, we're going to have an inflationary spiral the likes of which this country has never seen, and it's going to be very difficult to arrest it. You know, when people in Congress, for political reasons, talk about tax cutting, they're talking about usually items that affect maybe 0.6% of the national budget. I mean, there are three sacred cows: Social Security, Medicare, and military. And unless you're prepared to address the sacred cows, you're not going to have any great effect on spending. I mean, time after time, year after year, we see military spending that exceeds that which the military is requesting. It's because the military's been very smart. They've got contractors and companies in each one of the 435 House districts, each one of them, that are affected in one fashion or another. They may make one widget or another widget or a whole, you know, whether it be ball bearings or tanks. Anyway, the power is incredible. So each of the members of Congress, they're getting enormous pressure from within their district, and they want to pander to the special interests, those who are financing their campaigns. And as a result, we end up with the military getting things they don't even use. They mothball them, or, as we've seen recently, they give them to police departments, making this country look like an armed camp, like a banana republic, like a third world company in turmoil, when they roll in these armored vehicles to put down what is sometimes a peaceful demonstration. And it's pretty scary when you watch it on TV. You think, my God, what's happening to this country? Gee. So, yeah, I have pretty strong feelings about such things. I do think we have to rein in our spending dramatically, but it's going to take the courage of some elected officials to address the major problems, the major reasons that our spending is completely out of hand. You know, we cannot police the world. We cannot be invading countries without provocation, as one of the recent administrations did. We cannot destabilize a part of the world, which happened because of that type of reaction driven by ideological reasons at the top. And we wonder why we, at one time, were the beacon to the world, now we're reviled in many parts of the world. It just saddens me because I so love this country. I truly love this country. And I will always love this country. But we have major, major problems that have to be encountered, have to be addressed. They have to be done in a sensible, diplomatic way with compromise and not simply political expediency.
So fascinating. And some of the people we've talked about today are just so incredible in our history, current and past history. And you, at a very young age, before you were even in public office, your list of friends and law clients is equally as fascinating, including Johnny Cash and Steve McQueen, Charleston Heston, even Evel Knievel and many others. And there were also major corporations like TCI and Liberty Media and Ticketmaster, Sacramento Kings. It goes on and on. So how did that happen at such a young age? How did you make such amazing, fascinating friends and attract these clients?
Well, each developed, I suppose, in a different way, but many, no doubt, were facilitated by the fact that living on the California coast, in my case in Ventura, not far north of L.A., placed me in close proximity to a lot of people in the entertainment industry, and I believe I was sometimes attracted to them and they to me because of common interests, in some cases because, whether this is good or bad, we were fellow adrenaline junkies. And I write about quite a few of those people in my book. Every name you mentioned are friends of mine. And again, sometimes people with whom I did not agree philosophically, but I respected them to an immense degree. You know, Charlton Heston, I suppose, is a classic example. I do believe in the Second Amendment, but not to the degree he did. And it's tragic to me when, again, people simplistically remember him for the iconic photograph where he's holding the rifle up in his hand, saying that they will have to pry this from my cold, dead hand. You know, when you got to know him, and he was a client of mine, a friend of mine, a close friend of mine, he and his wife both, my ex-wife and I would often dine with them at their home down in the canyon in the Los Angeles area, Coldwater Canyon, and we would have long, long, thoughtful, philosophical discussions. And his point really was, this country will never have to be concerned about an invasion from abroad. It's just not going to happen. We can have terrorism. We no doubt will have terrorism, but nobody can effectively invade this country. Our big concern is not the governments without. Our biggest concern must be the governments within. He was a strong libertarian. He marched with Martin Luther King Jr. He had a heightened sense of environmental awareness. He was not a person that should be identified with one cause, one position, one iconic photograph, as people tend to do. People used to ask, gee, why is it that Heston always endorses you? Why is it that he puts on fundraisers for you? Well, it's because he and I were friends. We knew each other. We respected each other. We sometimes agreed, sometimes disagreed. I thought his position was too extreme, even though I'm a believer in the Second Amendment, in connection with the Second Amendment. But I fully understood how he arrived at that. And I respected even more today than I did then. So there are many different reasons. You know, Steve McQueen's another good example. He had a 1939 Pitcairn, which he kept at the Santa Paula airport. He loved to fly. And I got to know him in that fashion because it was in my district. We began to fly together. It was before Buffalo Burgers were that well known as they are today. The one place that served them was the airport on Catalina Island, so we would fly over there and do that. We would go up into the Sierras and do some fly fishing together, and we became very, very close friends, very fond. And, you know, I watched the Steve McQueen movies, and I think so fondly, because he was one of those classic examples where he didn't have to act. All he had to do was be himself, and he was great, because what you saw on the screen was just the way he was. I write extensively, not only about working with him, not only about flying with him, not only about doing outdoor experiences, because nature is my cathedral, but also about when he got cancer and went to Mexico for alternative treatments, and the way he reached out to me during the last week of his life, actually by telephone. He called me from Juarez, and he was very sad, very melancholy, because he knew he didn't have many days, and it was evident to me in the conversation that he had made a list of close friends that he really wanted to say goodbye to. And I remember crying when I hung up, because I thought, oh, my Lord, he won't be with us long, and he wasn't. But I could go right down the list of those you mentioned and others. They were all important to me, important to my life. And again, I write about most of those in my book, Back to the Summit. I do have a background in mountaineering, you know, whether it's Mount Everest or whether it's the Karakorams, the Himalayas, the Andes, Alaska, the Caputs, the Alps. You know, I've done a lot of climbing. But in this case, the summit is a metaphor for the recovery I made. And that's what the book is all about, the way in which I, having fallen into as close to death as one can ever be, arrived back at the summit. That has made my recovery.
So, Omer, you were leading such an amazing life, unlike most of us can even imagine. Do you have any idea why you might have suffered the aneurysm and stroke when you did?
You know, there was no genetic disposition, Vicki, that we know of, but I had a cascade of events that occurred within a nine-month period in 2002. It was the death of my mother, then of my only sibling, my brother. My father, who had been married to my mother for 66 years, was failing fast. And then while shouldering all of what had already happened and taking care of everything and everybody to the best of my ability, my wife of 30 years filed for divorce. And the doctors think the stress simply overwhelmed me and broke my body. I suspect they're right. I think the stress just became one which my body could not handle, could not accommodate to again or further. So it was a cascade of events that were horrific, but they occurred. We never know what tomorrow brings, and that's why it's important to live each and every day at a time and accept your blessings. My God, I get up every morning, I've got a sign right on the wall across from my bed, life is good. So then I open the paper, I look at the obituary page. If my name's not there, I think, wow, this day's off to a great start. I've got to make the best of it. So I lead one day at a time.
Fantastic. And while you're living one day at a time, tell us a little bit about what you're doing with your life today.
Since the recovery I did make, I have dedicated my life to humanitarian activities, building schools, libraries, economic development projects, women's empowerment centers in rural and remote parts of the developing world, principally in Nepal, India, and Bhutan, but also more recently in Latin America and in Africa. And that is the life I lead today, by and large. You know, I'm at an age where I'm slowing down, but I was the chairman of the board of REED Global. REED is an acronym for Rural Education and Development, for 8 years before I stepped down in order to, again, focus on projects all over the world, because we were, by this time, working with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they wanted us to continue our focus right in the specific area of Asia, and I wanted to broaden my outlook. So I gave 5 years' notice, and at the end of that five-year period, actually when I reached the age of 70, I did step down in that position, but remain, you know, chairman emeritus now. But my life is dedicated to the type of work I just described. I just got back from two countries in Latin America working on orphanages and schools. So anyway, my life is dedicated to that type of work, and it will be. And, you know, I'm going to be active physically. I'm going to be active mentally. And, you know, someday I die. I accept that. We all do. But I'll never be a couch potato. That's just so alien to my personality, to my thought process. It will never occur to me.
Unbelievable. Well, I cannot tell you what a treasure it has been for us to be able to spend time with you today. And I know that your book, Back to the Summit, the number one international bestseller, can be found on Amazon. But you also have a website, Omer, where people could go in and connect with you and learn more about the wonderful things that you're doing and contributing to the world?
Yes, I do. It's simply www.senorains, that's senorains.com. senorains.com. It will bring up the website, and or you can Google my name, it will come up. In fact, there's more information about me on my website than anyone would ever want to know. I can't lie about anything because it goes on so many pages. I mean, my life has been turned inside out, and I'm okay with that. I really am. The good, the bad, and the ugly, it's all there, and it's all there in the book. You know, I don't whitewash. I point out my flaws as well as my attributes, and I probably have a fair amount of attributes, probably even more flaws. I actually probably write more about my difficulties and challenges, encounters I had to overcome, my flaws, than any other part. But again, I do chronicle my life by flashbacks and flash forwards. And that's the way in which the book is tied together.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for the generosity of all of your wisdom and your time today, Omer. I can't tell you. It's so appreciated and so powerful.
Well, thank you kindly for giving me the opportunity to confer with you, and it means a lot. Again, I desperately hope that my book inspires others to never give up, no matter how great the challenge. And I will say one last thing. Each and every week, no exception, since that book came out, I get emails and phone calls from people all over the world asking for assistance, guidance, counsel, ways in which I overcame my challenge, and I do the best I can to assist those people. Maybe it's inadequate, but I do the best I can. So so that they, again, do not give up, so that they are driven to never, never give up. And I think I've helped a few people in it. If I helped one person, the book was worthwhile. That's why it was written.
So beautiful. So beautiful. So everyone, again, Back to the Summit can be found on Amazon.com. And again, Omer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Vicki. My pleasure.
And for those of you who would like to learn more about Expert Insights Publishing, our best-selling books, award-winning magazines, and our global broadcast and communities, you can find us at getei.com. That's G-E-T-E-I.com. And everyone have a wonderful week.